You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest is Dr. Frank James. Dr. James has two doctorates, a DPhil in history from Oxford University, and a PhD in theology from Westminster Theology. Dr. James has taught at Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando, Florida, where he also served as president, and Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary in South Hamilton, Massachusetts. Additionally, he served on teaching faculties at Villanova University and Westmont College, and was visiting professor at the Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies at Oxford University. Frank is married to the noted author Carolyn Custis James, and they have one grown daughter. Most of you will know Carolyn. She's been a previous guest on the show. Frank, thanks so much for being with me today.
I'm delighted to follow in Carolyn's footsteps.
That's right. I don't even think I mentioned that now currently you're at Biblical Theological Seminary.
That's right. I'm the president at Biblical Seminary in Philadelphia.
Excellent. So today we're here to talk about this new course that you've released with Logos, a church history course. How did this come about? Did they approach you about this?
Yeah, this is, they had, you know, I don't know exactly how it was that they got my name. I suspect that it may have come from a student in my years of teaching church history. And so they contacted me and asked me if I would teach the course. And so I went out there and had a wonderful time. My wife has family actually in the Northwest. She's from Portland, Oregon. So I got to have time with family.
You know, I think when people hear a video course, they're thinking something that like might be in the church library that you could pick up off the shelf. And maybe it's like, you know, maybe it's like 3 to 5 hours long, and you would get together with your small group or your Sunday school class and watch it for, you know, a month or so or something like that. Mm-hmm. This is much more akin to a full-on seminary course, I think.
Yeah, it is. And I think they call it their mobile app or their mobile sort of seminary kind of thing they're trying to do. So for those people who, well, say for instance, yourself, you know, who started seminary but who for whatever reason decided not to continue, this would be a great way to either supply additional information for a course or just to take courses for yourself. It's pretty serious, I think. And I would say, you know, they really maximize the use of technology. It is not sort of one camera fixed on someone behind a podium and who sort of drones on with a boring lecture. It's much more animated than that. And it's pretty high tech. So I actually enjoyed that.
Yeah, I want to say a word about just the quality of it, which I think is what you're kind of speaking to. It looks like, I mean, it looks like, I don't know, a video that like Apple would release or something. Like it's just, you know, high definition. You're just against a white background the entire time, but notes come on the screen. It's just very well done and very high quality.
Yeah, you know, of course, I had little to do with that.
Sure.
Logos are the ones who make it look good. You know, I just sort of did my thing. And I tend to be a fairly animated lecturer. So they can capture that and then jazz things up with other kinds of things.
So I should probably say a word real quick just about Logos in general, if people are unfamiliar with it. I think it kind of started out as a really great tool for pastors to do kind of sermon prep and you know, to study the Bible and stuff like that. It's a fantastic tool for that. I would say with the things that they've started doing the last couple of years, things like this video series that you did. It goes really beyond sermon prep, although it's a fantastic resource if someone's preaching on the early church or church history. So that's kind of what Logos is, and we'll have links to all this on the show notes to to Logos and all that, so people can get to it. I'm not in a pastorate position anymore, so I don't preach weekly. I probably preach at my church. I preach probably every quarter, just as a lay person, and I'm asked to preach at other places every now and then too. And so I don't get to use Logos, as frequently as some might. And there's a little bit of a learning curve to it, I think, just kind of navigating, and it is so complex. But it's a fantastic tool. So if you are new to it, if you've never heard of it before, that's kind of what we're dealing with. It's kind of a tool if you're in seminary, it's a no-brainer. You have to have Logos, and really, if you're in ministry at all, it's kind of one of the tools in your tool belt, I think. So
it especially focuses, on things like languages and helping you understand the original languages and what sort of in a particular text. It can help you understand sort of the syntax and the grammar of a text in a way that's very easy and accessible. So I'm not a great expert at it, but I know that it's very, very useful to students.
It absolutely. And I think, especially for someone like me who, never took Greek and Hebrew, and, we kind of need a cheat, if you will. It's just a fantastic resource for all that. So I think it's been fairly recent that they've kind of branched out and started to do these full-on courses, like I said, like you're doing.
Yeah, I think that's a new area. It's a competitive world, and so Logos is run by a guy, and I forget his name offhand, but he was, I think he was at, was he at Apple?
And
he was one of the early programmers, and he was a Christian. And he wanted to do something to serve the church. And so that's how that got started. At least that's the story I was told.
That's really cool. And I mean, they have, I don't want to drone on ad nauseum about just the organization, but I mean, there's a team of like top-notch scholars that work on things and develop these things. And then in coordination with, it sounds like, top-notch programmers and developers. Mm-hmm. It's just really, really impressive. So let's talk about the course a little bit itself. I have really in the last few years come to understand why church history and Christian history in general is just so very, very important. And I wonder what you would say to someone who is not sure why it's so important. Maybe they're a believer, but they, when they think about church history, they kind of think, yeah, that's for, people who want an academic pursuit, kind of, nerd out on church history and things. But I'm really more into just the devotional, study of scripture and, developing my relationship with God. What would you say to them about why church history is important to them?
Oh, boy, one of the things I hear students say when they have a class with me or really with anybody else is that it helps a student understand where they've come from. I mean, I can't tell you how many times students have said things like, oh, that's why my church believes that. And so it's really about a discovery of how you came to be you, why you believe the things you believe. And so it's really helpful in that sense. I think it's also helpful, particularly as we're living in a post-Christian era. One of the things for me that's important is to recognize that in church history, it tells us that the church has made some mistakes. We've done some stupid things. And for us to be able to acknowledge that, it helps us to, if you understand, to move forward So I'm a big fan of honesty and candor about our own history, because I think it's only when you're honest about your own history, and now I'm talking about, you know, church history, that we can then have a deeper, more profound experience with the Lord as we move into the future.
That's a really good point. I think a lot of us have kind of a vague sense of Christian history and church history, and it's a kind of a vague, glorious history. Like, we think about the martyrs and these people who really stood up for the faith and were just very, very serious about their faith. Knowing, you know, taking this course, it doesn't take away from any of that, but the details, they're a little bit more messy than that a lot of times.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things I say to students, I say it almost the first day of class, I say, if you're looking for a history, a version of history, it's just a parade of heroes, I said, you're in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. Because history, if you're going to be honest, is not a parade of heroes. The truth of the matter is that the folks who have shaped the Christian tradition from the very beginning had feet of clay, and sometimes they were extraordinarily unflattering and discouraging. A quick story. I wrote a textbook on the history of Christianity with my colleague John Woodbridge, and Carol and I read each other's stuff, and she's my final editor, and I'm sort of the final editor with her writings. And one of the things that I do is I ask her to look over the book, and she read this book's about 800 pages or so. And she said she read it, and she said when she finished it, she put her head down on her desk and just wept. Mm. And just literally wept. And I said, what was it? She said, you know, our history is not a pretty picture. And she said there are all kinds of not only unflattering but disturbing episodes in history. And I, you know, more recently I've had someone who read my book and said, you know, this could really be discouraging. And that's why when I teach a class, I have this little phrase that I use in every class. And I think it's a helpful one. And it's simply this, that God works through sinners to accomplish his good purposes. If you don't remember that, the history of the church can be disconcerting. But the good news is that if God can work through such flawed people as he has in the past, there's hope for you and me, Shane. Mm, mm. Can I get an amen?
Yeah, you can. Amen. One of the things that I was thinking about as I was going through the course was that studying Christian history and being aware of church history, it really makes you a more graceful person towards those whose theology is a little bit different. Because I think we have this concept that these are the parameters of what a Christian believes today. And to be a Christian or to be a good Christian, you have to believe these things. Yeah. And a lot of times, those parameters are a little too tight. And when you read about church history and you realize that, wow, even, man, some of these church fathers, they believe some things that we think is a little bit weird today.
What? It's one of the great ironies. You know, if you look today and you take Lutherans, for example, if you go to a typical Lutheran church and you try to compare what they affirm with what Luther taught, there's a pretty big gap. Same thing with Presbyterians and John Calvin. Same thing with Wesley and then the Methodist Church. You know, there actually is very often some substantial differences that emerge over time because the world changes and you have to have a theology that responds and will, whether you like it or not, it will respond to differing circumstances. And what happens is you hope by God's grace that your theology is refined And if it's true that we are always refining our theological systems, if you will, then you are going to inevitably have, there are going to be some differences. And I hope that what happens is, if to recognize that, will give you, as you say, a little more graciousness, a little grant people a little more latitude, because you're on a journey and so are they. And to pretend, and it really is pretentious and pretending to think you've got it all figured out. When I was in seminary, I had it all figured out, Shane. I knew I had it all. Everything was systematized. I had it all figured out. And then life happened. Mm-hmm. And then I discovered that my system really wasn't able to minister to me in the ways that I think it should have. And you know that's one of the lessons that I think church history can also help with, is just to see how, I mean, Luther's a great example. He had the system all figured out. He was a Roman Catholic monk. He had it all lined up. And then he gets sort of struck with the German word is Anfechtungen. It's a kind of depression. It's a kind of wrestling, a spiritual anxiety. You know, how is it that I am actually measuring up to God's expectations in and of myself? And he looked deep into his own heart. He said, I'm not measuring up. So what am I going to do? Mm-hmm. And through that, he discovered, you know, we talk about justification by faith alone. I typically just say he learned about the grace of God, and that was transformative for him. So church history has all kinds of those experiences. One of the other things I often, the way I approach church history, it's really human stories. It's people like you and me, and people who are hopefully trying to know God in right ways and to live out their faith in right ways. And through all the ups and downs of life and changes and tragedies and difficulties. So that's what it is. And what is more interesting than studying flawed people who are trying to do good things? I mean, there's a wonderful sort of inherent tension in all of that, which is inherently interesting to me. So anyway, that's when you realize that church history is not about grand schemes, if you will. It's really about people like us trying to figure out what's the best, how do we serve God in my particular circumstance? I mean, in a way, that's really what it's about.
So let's talk about the early church for a little bit. I wonder if you could set the scene for what an early church gathering would have looked like.
Yeah, they were house churches. That's a new thing happening. It seems like today younger people are frustrated with more institutionalized churches. But it'd be people, you know, and usually small people that gather in somebody's house. And one of the things that I think you might find surprising and interesting, at least an American audience, is you'd have 20, 30 people, maybe, gathering, and the centerpiece of worship was not a sermon. It was the Lord's Supper. And that was you go really the first number of centuries, the sermon, while not unimportant, was not the centerpiece. And so they came together, small groups, men and women, and they would do the Lord's Supper. There might be a word of preaching from a senior member of the group, perhaps. But it was actually a very, very intimate. People knew each other very, very well, because on the one hand, it was somewhat risky. You know, you could only go to church with people you really, really trusted, because in the early church, you could lose your life for being identified with a Christian community. So you only went to church with, frankly, people you really, really trusted. And probably one of the most extraordinary things that just was so countercultural was that these small gatherings, you'd have rich people and poor people, masters and slaves, men and women. Now, I can't tell you how revolutionary that was. Certainly, masters and slaves didn't go to the same small place to worship their god or gods. So there was an egalitarian characteristic of this early church that is quite remarkable. So it would have been small, intimate, and there had to be a lot of trust.
What about leadership in that gathering?
Yeah, the leadership question is fascinating because it sort of depends on when you're talking. We know, for example, in the Philippian church, that Lydia, was a leader. And so, we actually have some archaeological data that suggest that women took a much more active leadership role in those churches. So it's only by about once the church becomes sort of the official church of the empire in the fourth century under Constantine, it's only then do you sort of get organized and create hierarchy in the church. Before that, there's some hierarchy. You do sometimes have a presiding elder or bishop or something like that. But it was pretty diverse. And you had different kinds of people assuming roles of leadership. And there's also just a lot we don't know.
In their new InterVarsity Press book, The Church's Movement, co-authors Dan White Jr. and J.R. Woodward had a fantastic quote, so I asked Dan about it. Dan, one of the other great quotes from the book was, "God has placed us into a family that crosses every boundary made by people, people from every tribe, tongue, and nation." Why was that important in a book about church planting?
Well, I think most church planters still have in their imagination a preferred people group that they'd like to see in their church, more of an affinity-based church planting approach. Or even most people, when they attend church, think through affinity. I want to be in a church with people that are just like me and look just like me and vote just like me. And for me, I'm finding that the front edge of mission is beginning to poke and prod at those boundaries of affinity and understand that the New Testament isn't one of rallying around affinity. I mean, our imagination for what happened in the New Testament is probably anemic. There's Jews and Gentiles that were former enemies that are now sharing a meal together. What would it look like for Democrats and Republicans to enjoy fellowship in the same church together? Those are explosive boundaries that I think that we're trying to challenge when it comes to understanding the church as family rather than affinity. So that's why that quote was in there. I really think it's the front edge of mission.
For a limited time, you can get The Church's Movement by going to ivp.com/dropout. and getting 30% off. That's 30% off. Go to ivpress.com/dropout. Something I've always wondered about the early church, and I don't know if this is something that we know, but I wonder how structured the meeting was. When we go to church today, someone has spent a lot of time, for instance, picking out music, practicing mm-hmm. playing that music, and mm-hmm. that is all decided ahead of time. And I wonder if it was a little more informal in that way, if they got together and said, "Hey, why don't we sing this song or this chant mm-hmm. or this kind of thing?" How structured was it?
Well, it's like everything else, it developed over time. I think there's little doubt that it was much less structured early on. Because, again, it was a risky thing to meet with other persecuted people. So, but then over time, inevitably human organizations become more and more structured over time. It's sort of an evolutionary process. So, by the mid-second century, you start seeing evidence of a little more organization. In the larger cities, it would be more organized than it would be, for example, in the rural villages. So it depends on where you are and what stage of development, what period of time you are in the church. By the 4th, 5th century, it becomes much more hierarchical and organized. And they would, at that point, certainly plan out the service in more detail.
So you talked a little bit about just the leadership structure inside the church. One of the early lessons that in the course, you talk about how originally the church kind of adopts a leadership model of the Jewish temple. So there's like, there's, my understanding is there's elders and then there's deacons. Is that right?
Well, yeah, that would have been fairly early. We start seeing those structures. There were no deacons in the synagogue, so that seems to be an innovation, if I recall correctly, of the Christian church. And there's, that's significant because the deacons are the ones who distribute whatever food and funding there is for the poor.
So, and then after that, after a little while, there becomes bishops appear on the scene, which are kind of overseers of several churches, right?
Well, the word presbyter or elder and bishop are essentially the same. So it would depend. As in a large city, you're going to have more than one church. And it did happen that over time, you would have a bishop emerge with some measure of authority over a group of churches, particularly in a larger city. So yes.
The thing that struck me as I was going through that portion of the course was that today, you know, there are a lot of people in a lot of churches who take pride in saying that we have a New Testament leadership structure or model in our church. Basically, they're saying, like, we're doing it the way the Bible says we're supposed to. But I got more of the feeling that the church was kind of just making it up as they went along, just really just being practical and saying, here's this need. We need some leadership in this area. Am I on to anything there?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. We tend to think that, from on high, a structure of how the church was supposed to function came down full blown. No, it was a process development. And it also depended on whether it was in a more Jewish context or a Gentile context. I mean, you can't, just like, I sometimes tell people, you probably can't do church in New York City the way you do it in Texas.
Yeah.
They're just a different, not only are the accents differently, but there are different cultural assumptions that go into how you do church in Texas, where I grew up. But that probably wouldn't exactly work in New York City, which is a different dynamic. And so, again, as the church, it's an organic development. And I think I would stress that very strongly. There's organic development and in the church and its leadership structure, and that would differ from region to region. And there may be some differences in different places because it was an organic process.
So in the church, you had people who had been baptized, and then you had the catechumen.
Mm-hmm.
They were, my understanding is they were people who were basically in training to be baptized, and sometimes that would last for like 2 to 3 years.
Oh yeah, very detailed.
What did that training consist of?
Well, it one of the things it did is, you find, catechumens, the whole word itself suggests catechesis, and it's the idea of making sure, you take, the Apostles' Creed, for example. That's an ancient summary of the faith, and we think that goes back at least to the 2nd century, so that you work with a person who is indicated interest in the faith and who may very well already be Christians, but you want to make sure that they kind of have the basics down, who Christ was, what the cross was. Particularly emphasis on the resurrection, I think, was also, certainly a piece of that. So even before, things like, detailed doctrinal developments come along, there are still some basic kinds of elements that they wanted any new member to understand about the faith. And then there was also a devotional element. I think that's another piece to the catechumen's life, is that it wasn't just head knowledge. There was a discipleship going on, which included the head, but also the heart and the nurturing of one's faith. And what is more, all of that is especially important in a period of persecution. Because when you prepare for baptism, you could very well be taking your life in your own hands. So to be identified with this crazy sect called Christians. So this is very serious business. And so the early church did take considerable interest and time in making sure that a person understood what the essence of the faith was, and then for discipleship, because it could be pretty hairy going.
Was there some sort of physical signification of someone who had been baptized? I mean, how did outsiders know whether someone had been baptized or not?
As far as I know, there were no tattoos or anything.
Yeah, scarlet letters or something. Yeah.
No, I don't think there was anything offhand. You know, there were symbols. You know, the fish, for example. I was in Ephesus one time, there were a couple of places, and the guy pointed out that somebody had drawn a fish in front of a certain, I think it was a house or something. So while they didn't have anything on themselves that I'm aware of, there were signals, if you will, or indications that, you know, this house with, if they had the fish sign located in some location, would indicate that this is a safe house. But as far as I know, those are the only kinds of things that you would have.
Most churches now that don't practice infant baptism practice, you know, believer's baptism. So in other words, you know, pretty much as soon as that person believes, they're baptized. Did the early church have a different understanding of baptism, or was it more of the practical consideration of, you will likely face persecution, so you need to make sure that this is a really well thought out decision if you do this?
Well, certainly, making sure this is a well thought out commitment is certainly true. But the whole baptism question, you have to remember that the new converts in the early church were not infants, they were adults. And so in the New Testament, for example, all the examples we have are of adult baptism, because that's just, those were the people who were being baptized. And it's only over time that we have the development. I think Origen, really about the third century, makes a statement. You know, by that time, the third century, you've had a couple of generations. And if you've been baptized as an adult, then you have a family. And particularly with the Jewish heritage where children were marked with a sign of inclusion by circumcision, that, you know, the whole idea of baptism then became the means by which you and your family were marked for inclusion. So it's pretty clear that the early centuries, because the only candidates for baptism were adults, where there was adult baptism based on a profession of faith. But then I think fairly early, you know, you're talking probably second century, you start finding in that infant baptism of some sort is emerging and really becomes the dominant view for well over 1,000 years before it was challenged by the Anabaptist movement in the 16th century.
One of the things that you emphasize in the early lessons in the course was just the rapid growth of Christianity. And I think that's something that, again, I think a lot of us who have a cursory knowledge of church history are vaguely aware of, but it is quite remarkable how rapidly, exponentially the church grew in those early years.
Yeah, you know, I think persecution has something to do with that in a way. I think one of the things that's characteristic of that early church is its very high practical morality. I mean, you know, the freeing of slaves, one of my best examples of how Christians behaved that really shocked the pagan world was on the question of infanticide. it was characteristic of the Greco-Roman world that if one had a female child, pagans were, because female infants were less valuable than male infants. And so they would often leave them to die of exposure. And we have all kinds of data that shows that in villages and little towns, there was what they call the dung heap. That's where all the refuse was. And if a pagan family would have a female, maybe a second female, and they'd say, "This is, there's no value in this. There's no payoff for a female." So they take the little infant and leave her out on the dung heap to die of exposure. And there are two things that could happen to that little girl. One was that she would simply die of exposure. That was actually the better option, because the other option was that some pagan priest would rescue the child and then raise her as a temple prostitute. And so she would spend her life effectively being sexually abused. And knowing all of that, these Christians, and much, much to their praise, they would go out, and imagine the picture in your mind of climbing through a mound of human dung to rescue a stinking little baby, and taking that little baby and raising her as your own. Or if it was a boy, sometimes if a boy was born with some a deformity, they would also cast the male child on the dung heap. But these Christians, these crazy Christians, were going out there and rescuing these little babies. And so Rodney Stark, who's at Baylor, has done some magnificent work in this area. It's astonishing that a pagan world, which had really never seen anything quite like this, began to be intrigued and curious. What? Why would they go rescue these disposable infants? What was it about them? And so I think there was a measure of curiosity that emerged, and people began to ask questions. And Rodney Stark, I think, he does a great job of arguing that Christianity really spread largely through family affiliations or close friends. Because you had to often be able to trust people, because there was a measure of persecution going on. So you had to be careful. But those are some of the things that there was something quite unusual about Christianity, and that manifested itself in the behavior of followers of Christ. And I think the pagans began to see it. One other thing that factor that seems to have played into all of this is that the persecution of Nero, for example, was so intense and horrific and cruel that even the pagans, who sometimes had a taste for the cruelty, think of the games in the Colosseum, for example, with gladiators, they had a kind of a taste for blood. But when they saw how merciless the persecution was of Christians, some of these pagans said, "Whoa, what's that about? What's this going on?" And so a certain amount of empathy began to emerge. And so you have pagans doing things, like you have, Germans in World War II hiding Jews from the Nazis. Mm-hmm. Well, there are some indications that you have pagans who are hiding Christians from persecutors because they just couldn't understand all this horrific treatment of these people who were rescuing babies. So empathy comes out too, and I think in the process.
When you were talking about that part in the course about the Christians rescuing these abandoned infants, I also thought about how that must have meant giving up a lot of prosperity for them. I mean, it seems like these people were giving up these children because basically it would just cost them, right, to keep these children. And so for Christians to take disabled boys, to take girls, there was no monetary gain in that. In fact, it would probably cost them. And so I wonder if they were resigning themselves to a life of, if not poverty, being less prosperous in the process.
Yeah, I think it's quite clear that, I mean, Christians, one of the things that characterized them is that there wasn't this aspiration typically for wealth, because they're giving it away. I mean, they're really good at pooling their resources in order to give it away. And so they were certainly willing to make financial sacrifices to rescue these infants, for example. So I mean, there are any number of warnings in the New Testament about the undue lust for money. And I think these early Christians really had a much better perspective on wealth and finances in some ways, I think, than perhaps we do. They're really quite sacrificial in the way they lived.
Real quick, let's talk about persecution, because you've mentioned it on and off. It sounds like, from what I learned from the course, that persecution kind of had some starts and stops,
right,
and was kind of a local thing. But then in, I think it was 250, where it really becomes kind of, you know, country is not the right word, but empire-wide, and really kind of codified, it seems like, more systematic at that point.
Right. That's a good point. It's true that there were, mostly up until around 250 AD, the persecutions were mostly local. Now, let's be clear. Even if it's a local persecution, it can be terrible and bloody, mm-hmm, and awful. You know, so that's one thing that needs to be said. And it's probably helpful to understand that the persecution wasn't 24/7 in every place all the time. There were some pockets in the empire where people just felt like they had other things to do than ferret out Christians. You know, so it's a little more, it's broader than that. And even when Nero or some of our Diocletian in particular laid out an empire-wide policy, it wasn't always enforced in every quarter of the empire. I mean, some folks just had other things better to do.
So the last thing I want to say about the course is that I found it to be somehow incredibly in-depth and also really accessible. And I don't know, you know, my worry is that one crowd would be intimidated by such a course, and that another crowd would, you know, dismiss it because it's on a platform that's available for everyone. Personally, I think, I don't know, you tell me what you think, but I think someone with, one, an interest and, you know, just at least maybe a high school education could really get into this and benefit from it.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's possible to have, you know, solid academic work, but that you can distill that in such a way that everyone would find it interesting. Let me go back to something I said earlier. These are human stories, and you can do all kinds of academic research to unearth all the various aspects of theological controversies, the way people live, archaeology, and so forth, and you can turn it into a very, very technical kind of thing. But I've never done that. I don't understand that exactly. What I think is that these are living, breathing human beings. And there's a story, and I've been accused, I use that word facetiously, accused of being a storyteller, and I really am. And I think that one can have intellectual credibility and still tell the story of real people, real circumstances, in such a way that it's not only interesting to a wide range of people, whatever their educational background, and secondly, that it will illumine for them where they come from, how Christians got from A to B. And I think it can also be very, very inspirational. I mean, for me to look back and think about those those early Christians who probably didn't have a lot of education, but they were willing to go out to the dung heap and rescue those little girls. My goodness, I have been so deeply inspired by those stories that to this day, I even now talking about it, it grabs my heart. And it makes me want to be a little more countercultural, a little more bold in living out my faith.
Yes. Well, the questions that I've asked you that were based on the course were only based on about a tenth of it, because it's like I said, it's very in-depth and very comprehensive. And when I started, I thought, when I actually saw the lesson, I thought, I'm not going to be able to get through near as much of this as I would like to before I talk with Frank. But I plan on going back just because, one, it was so engaging, and I learned so much from the portions that I was able to take.
Good.
So I've got a coupon code for people, and I think I'm going to make people go to the show notes to get that coupon code. So it'll be there. You'll get $100 off the bundle. So this is, it's a course. So there's several lessons, and the bundle includes all of the lessons. And, it's not cheap, but it is well worth the price. And I think when you see the tremendous work that went into it, you understand why the price is what it is. It's certainly cheaper than a seminary course. And like I said, if you get this coupon code, go to the show notes, go to seminarydropout.com, find this episode. And this is going to be good until the end of September 2016, which is the year we are in right now. But if you're listening far in the future, sorry, it's a little too late. But you'll get $100 off that bundle. So that's a pretty big discount for you there. Frank, some of my listeners know I send out a survey to everybody I interview beforehand. And one of the questions I ask is there anything you want me to ask? And one of the things, the question that you said is why Shane should finish seminary, a biblical theological seminary. So here's your chance, Frank. Yeah. Plug biblical seminary for us.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm a tad cheeky. That my wife accuses me of that regularly, and I just thought I would seize the opportunity to be a little cheeky with you, even though I don't really, I've never met you. What I would say is, let me give this a little context here. You need to understand that seminaries, evangelical seminaries in the United States, are in a period of decline. The truth of the matter is, seminaries have most of them, the language I use, tend to have what I call a monastic model. We've got the truth, and if you want it, come here and be with us, and we'll huddle in our little groups and our little classrooms, and we'll have great scholars give you great lectures, and you'll get all truth, and then you'll go out and then you'll disperse that truth in your from your pulpits or from an academic podium someplace. What I think, and again, I don't know your story personally about why you dropped out. There are lots of reasons why people start and then decide not to finish. I mean, there are economic issues. There are all kinds of things that go on. But what we do that I think is absolutely different. When I came on, I was hired 3 years ago, and I've been aching to do something like this for the longest time. But I told my interviewers that I felt like what we had to do was reinvent seminary. The current models simply don't work. And so what we have to do is rethink everything from top to bottom. What is seminary? What is it supposed to accomplish? How do we prepare people for real life ministry? And so this idea of real life ministry has been very, very important to me. Now, the last thing I want to do is prepare people for a world that doesn't exist. I have a phrase that I've always said, we prepare people for the world, not the world that was, but the world that is. And so, among other things, we want to make sure that our students, so for example, we try to rethink what is a classroom. And so we think a viable classroom, for example, might be a prison. So we have people who are in the prison system, and we'd like to have our classes, our teachers and our students go into a prison cell or to a prison room and have prisoners who profess faith in Christ and who want to learn sitting side by side with our students. And so you teach Paul's prison epistles, for example, in a prison.
Wow.
And we believe that the Bible will come alive in a way that it never has before. We want to put students into homeless shelters. I have a class there. We want to put them in businesses where, because the truth of the matter is, many of the people that will be in your churches will be business people. So do you speak their language? Do you understand what motivates them? Do you understand the ethical challenges that are often inherent in a capitalistic system? How do you manage all of that? So for our students to actually have internships and have classes in a variety of contexts, we're convinced that will revolutionize the teaching of Scripture. It'll revolutionize, I think, even the teaching of history in a way. So that's one thing. And I can imagine, Shane, if you were taking a seminary class, and let's say in a prison system, there's something pretty powerful and maybe even overwhelming by that.
Mm.
Another thing that we're doing, again, this is when I came on board, they knew they were getting, I told the interviewing committee, the search committee, that if you're looking for somebody to sort of do things as they've always been done, I said, I'm not your guy. Find somebody else. But if you're looking for somebody who wants to really do things differently, I said, I want to figure out what that is. So one of the other things we're talking about is pedagogy. How do you teach in whatever the setting, how do you teach? And one of the things I've landed on, and I think our faculty do in some measure already, and that is what business schools already do, and that's a case study methodology. That is to say, you go from practice to theory, not theory to practice.
Mm.
So imagine this. Here's the scenario that I laid. I'm going to teach a class this semester, and this is what I'm going to do. The first day of systematic theology class, let's say. You know, you have typically the doctrine of God. And typically what you do is you begin with all these theoretical constructs. God is infinite. And God is, you know, omnipresent. And all these concepts that, frankly, are just, you know, we've come up with these ideas. And I'm sure they're true. It's not as if they're not true. But instead of starting there, what we want to do is have, let's say this. You have a young lady come into the class. And she tells the story of how she was trafficked. Mm. Okay? And she addresses the question, maybe questions come up in a discussion, where was God? What kind of God is it that would allow this to happen? And very quickly, you're no longer doing theology as abstraction. You're doing theology in a real life existential sort of construct. And I believe that the Bible, I believe that theology will come alive in a whole new way, and that it will have a relevance that I fear has been lost all too often in many seminary situations. So I'm in the business of reinventing seminary. And Shane, I think that it might, maybe not, but there might have been a different result for you if you'd gone into a prison setting to have your class, and if that class began with, say, a prisoner talking about their life of crime, how their father beat them when they were young, how their mother abandoned them, they were left to themselves, their own, you know, devices, and they tell the story how they got addicted to drugs, and which then led to crime. Is that going to capture your heart, mind, and soul in a different way? So that seminary is not this dull, dusty, arid kind of concept, but in fact is a real-life encounter with the world as it is, and then you have time to reflect and think and be guided about how then do I minister? How do I really do real ministry? And so those are some of the things that I think I would say to you, and I say to students who are thinking about coming to seminary. We don't do things here the way that everybody else does. We are rethinking the whole concept, and I could not be more excited. So we're either going to crash and burn or we're going to be the best thing going. So how's that, Shane?
I love it. I think that's so much, I think that's so much better than spending a lot of time and money developing a theology and then going out into the real world where you realize it doesn't add up.
Absolutely.
And you have to then go and deconstruct. You can kind of, you know, test case your theology in real time. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. Well, those are the kind of things that we're doing here, and we're fortunate because we're in Philadelphia, which has the largest millennial population in the United States. And so, one of the things the Pew Research came out with that data just in the last 6 months. Partly that's because of all the colleges and universities here. But we've made the fundamental decision. We have our main campus here is in a suburb of Philadelphia. And we've made the decision to move the entire seminary to the city. We want to go inside. We want to be where people are, the hustle and the bustle, the good, the bad, and the ugly. We want to be there. We know it's going to be messy, but life is messy. Ministry is messy. And you can't learn how to minister in a messy context if you're preparation doesn't expose you to that. So we've made some pretty radical decisions. Most seminaries that began in the city years ago are leaving the seminaries to go to the nice, safe, tidy, clean suburbs. We're doing the opposite.
Well, Frank, thank you for all of that. Thanks for taking the time. And, yeah. You know, I just have to say again, when I was taking the course, I couldn't believe that I was getting to take it. And then it was answering so many questions that I've always had about the early church. And I feel like it really, on a devotional level, is impacting and benefiting my spiritual life. So thanks for all the hard work.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure. I love what I do. I'm one of those very, very fortunate people who gets to do something they really, really love.
Frank, thanks for being on the show. Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have, and I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at Beard on a Bike. That's at Beard on a Bike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,